until 2 p.m. right here on KBOO. And it is just a few seconds before 11 a.m. You are tuned to KBOO in Portland, and coming right up is Health Watch. Host David Naiman speaks with award-winning journalist Paul Rayburn, author of Do Fathers Matter? They discuss the many myths and stereotypes of fatherhood. And at 11:30 on Health and Healthcare Forum, host Roberta Hall interviews Diana Rollman and Laurel Kinkle of OSU's Environmental Health Sciences Outreach and Engagement Program about new devices to monitor air pollution. And once again, I want to thank KBOO members for your generous support for community radio. If you are not a member, you can become one. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches, and breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or facebook.com/Grendel's Coffee House.
The purpose of this program is not to prescribe a treatment to individuals. Listeners should consult their healthcare practitioner before attempting any treatment.
Good morning and welcome to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host. Today's guest, Paul Rayburn, is chief media critic for the Knight Science Journalism Tracker site at MIT. He's the author of Acquainted with the Knight, A Parent's Quest to Understand Depression and Bipolar Disorder in His Children. He's a regular guest on NPR and writes the About Fathers blog for Psychology Today. Paul Rayburn has been the science editor at Business Week and the Associated Press, is the past president of the National Association of Science Writers, and his work has appeared in the New York Times Magazine, Discover, and Scientific American. He's here today on Health Watch to talk about his latest book, Do Fathers Matter? What Science is Telling Us About the Parent We've Overlooked. Welcome to Health Watch, Paul Rayburn.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Well, let's start out with the question, do fathers matter? What is the story of how you became captivated by this question?
Well, my previous book that you were nice enough to mention was about some problems some of my kids had during adolescence with depression and bipolar disorder. They're doing much better now, but we had some tough times there, and I wrote about that and a lot of the failures of the medical system and how hard it was to figure out what to do and get a correct diagnosis. And when I finished that book, I thought, you know, I was interested in what fathers do for their kids aside from helping deal with illnesses, and just more broadly, you know, what fathers contribute. We all walk around, I think, with notions in our head about, you know, about our experiences with our own fathers and those of us who are fathers and our experiences with our kids. And, you know, the idea here was to say, okay, well, we all think we know a lot about fathers. What does the science really show? So I wanted to cut through any myths and misconceptions we might have to see what we really know.
Well, it was interesting at the beginning of the book, you go back to the 1970s when psychologists basically didn't think fathers contributed anything other than financial security through the workplace. But you point out that there was little evidence at the time of what fathers contributed, but there was also just little evidence at all about whether they were relevant or irrelevant. Why do you think that fathers up until recently have been so much less studied than mothers?
Well, I think we were, I don't know, and, you know, that's not a question you can answer with research, but my theory is, my idea is that we were a victim of our economy. And what I mean by that is, if you go back, way back to the 19th century, nobody questioned the relevance of fathers. Fathers ran the farm or they ran the shop in town. And they were vitally important to the family's welfare. And furthermore, the kids spent a lot of time with the father as soon as they were old enough to help in the fields or the barn or clean out the troughs or whatever they do at farms. They would spend a lot of time with their fathers. And so that changed, you know, with the industrial era when fathers went off to factories. And I think we forgot. We got so used to the fact that fathers were away all day, many fathers, and mothers were home all day with the kids. It's just, see, we thought, well, of course mothers are more important. They're the ones home with the kids. You know, how hard can that be? But that was just a temporary, although it lasted about a century, that was a temporary situation, as we discovered over the last couple of decades when we entered a new era where now it was very hard for one parent to support the family in a lot of cases. Mothers started going to work for wages outside the home, and many families, two parents work. So around the time when the economy was changing again into this sort of more complicated situation we have now, people began to look at fathers. You know, one of the good things, it's rough on families when both parents have to work sometimes, but one of the good things is some fathers in this transition have been able to spend more time with their kids, and suddenly that raises all kinds of questions. What are they doing there? How's that working out?
Sure. And with the rise of the study of epigenetics, and paternal inheritance, that was one of my favorite parts of Do Fathers Matter, the things that can be passed on transgenerationally. Can we talk a little bit about some of what you've discovered in terms of paternal inheritance in the studies?
Sure. Well, there are a couple of different areas here. One of them is what happens at conception and during the development of the fetus before birth. I think we like to think of this as a lovely, harmonious process. You know, DNA from the mother and DNA from the father come together, each contributes half, and the fetus grows in a very specific pattern and, you know, begins to look like a baby, more and more like a baby as we see through ultrasound and so forth. And it's a wonderful, it's a miracle. And of course it is a miracle in some ways. It's a wonderful thing, and it brings great emotional satisfaction to parents and others involved. But in fact, the genetics are much more complicated. Father's genes actually control a lot of what happens in the mother's body. So the father equips the fetus with genes that can do a couple of things. Genes that can alter the mother's blood pressure. So in that way, operating through the placenta, the developing fetus has control. If it's not getting enough nutrients, it can release substances to boost its mother's blood pressure to pump more nutrients through the placenta to the fetus. And likewise, if it's not getting enough sugar, enough energy, and carbohydrates, it can alter that too and force the mother to contribute more carbohydrates to the fetus. This is an amazing thing that the fetus can actually be in control of some of these things. And one way we know that this happens, that some listeners I'm sure will understand, is that there are a couple of conditions that can happen to pregnant women. One is something called preeclampsia, in which they get dangerously high blood pressure. That's what happens when the fetus exerts too much control on the mother. So it can actually threaten the health of the mother and the fetus. The other is what's called gestational diabetes, women who've never had diabetes but develop it during pregnancy. And again, that's when the fetus's genes that it got from its father are, you know, going a little awry as they control the mother's blood sugar. So this is actually a tug of war between father's genes and mother's genes. And in the ideal case, things balance and everything turns out fine and the baby is born healthy. But sometimes it can go wrong. But I found that, as you did, I found that incredibly interesting to think of a tug of war going on between genes rather than a nice, lovely bonding.
Well, I was actually thinking more specifically about the implications around a father's diet and lifestyle preconception. And we know that there's all this emphasis on women and mothers, obviously, and what their diet and lifestyle is in for the growing fetus and in preparation for getting pregnancy. But we're now starting to also learn that that's going to have a big effect on how genes are expressed in a fetus based on the behavior of the father, even preconception.
That's right. And, you know, people have done studies. I have some interesting things in the book about looking at different fathers' occupations and some occupations dealing with some toxic chemicals and things, as you say, even before conception, that raises the risk of certain ailments and disorders in their children. And this is not supposed to happen in classical genetics. You know, you inherit things from your parents and you pass them on to your kids, and whatever you live through in the meantime doesn't affect any of that. But the short answer is now we're finding that it does affect that. And in fact, studies looking back at health records, you know, over a century in Sweden little town way up near the Arctic Circle have shown that not only does this happen in sons, that grandfather's diet can affect their sons, and that also continues to affect their grandsons. So we don't know how long, if this would continue indefinitely, but we now know that these things that, as you say, are called epigenetic changes are very important, and a lot of people are now studying these to try to find out what's going on and how we can prevent some of the consequences.
Well, it was interesting. Some of the results were a little mystifying, even that if a grandfather experienced hunger, that the mortality risk of the grandchild is decreased.
Yeah, right. You might think it was the other way, that if the grandfather had a rough time getting enough food to eat, that his progeny might suffer for that. But you're exactly right. Grandfathers who didn't get enough to eat during adolescence, their grandchildren did better at a lower mortality rate. So nobody yet knows what's going on there. I mean, the science is good and clear that shows there is this phenomenon. This is happening. But the next step will be to figure out why and how that is happening, which I will surely be following and probably writing about because I'm interested to know.
Yeah, and some of the studies on rodents actually seem to suggest the possibility of passing down emotional trauma genetically. That, for instance, a startle response, a specific type of fear response, could be not a learned behavior from your parent or your grandparent, but could actually be also something that's passed down through gene expression.
Right, and this is, I mean, listeners who are familiar with this will be, you know, interested to know, I think, too, that, you know, this was, this thing first started to be discovered over the last 10 years, maybe less than that, you know, there was huge reaction from other scientists saying, no, this is not possible. We know this isn't possible. Gregor Mendel, the father of genetics, said it wasn't possible, and Darwin, too, for that matter. So it's been a huge revolution in science with all kinds of back and forth, which, you know, ultimately is beginning to resolve with the conclusion that, yeah, this stuff really does happen.
We're talking today to author Paul Raeburn about his latest book, Do Fathers Matter? What Science is Telling Us About the Parent We've Overlooked. So, Paul, let's talk about the changes that happen to fathers during pregnancy. There are actually, we're discovering hormonal changes, weight changes, all sorts of changes that are happening to the father of the child while the mother is pregnant.
That's right. And so it turns out women's no longer have a lock on all the hormonal changes involved with pregnancy. Once we thought that they went through a lot of changes and men were more or less on the sidelines waiting for the birth, which was the big event. Now we know that's not the case. So some listeners may be aware that it's not uncommon for men to gain weight during their wives' pregnancy or partner's pregnancy. And it's not just because they're both overeating, although that might be happening too. But in fact, there's a real connection there and a phenomenon where men will gain weight. And some men even develop a kind of a morning sickness because of their connection with their spouse. And the weight gain thing, and there's actually a really interesting example in the animal kingdom. We know that helps us believe what we see in human animals. There's a monkey called the titty monkey in South America, little guy, and he gains a lot of weight. The male gains a lot of weight when his partner is pregnant. And the reason is that when the offspring show up, and there are a group of them, when they're not nursing, he carries them. They spend their entire time on his back, and he carries them around. So he can lose 40% of his body weight after the litter is born. So he has to gain weight before birth or he won't survive all this shuttling of these offspring around. So same kind of thing can happen in humans. The other thing, as you say, is that these hormonal changes that occur in women are matched by things that occur in men. So when men are spending time and closely associated with their partner who's pregnant, they experience a sharp drop in testosterone. Testosterone is, you know, roughly associated with competitiveness and aggression and that sort of thing. It's not a simple link, but they are associated with one another. And the idea is that when testosterone falls during a woman's pregnancy, it falls in a man, that his biology is preparing him to be a father, to be a little less competitive, a little less aggressive, and more nurturing and more available for this child who's about to arise. So it's a pretty neat system. And until very recently, nobody had any idea this thing was going on.
And some of the studies suggest that the more you hold your baby as a man, the lower your testosterone will go. Is that correct?
Yes. So that's right. So holding the baby and playing with the baby, even when the kids are a little older, fathers who spend time with their kids playing, reading to them, all those things, have lower testosterone levels. They also, there's another hormone that kicks in here, and I'm sure you're familiar with this, and that's the hormone oxytocin, which is associated with bonding between individuals and emotional connections. And it turns out that when fathers spend a lot of time with their kids, their oxytocin rises. So that's the science. That's been measured and studied, and that's clear. It's also true, it works the other way too. If fathers are given a little dose of oxytocin before playing with their children, they're much more engaged, much more active, and have a better play session. This has been seen in the laboratory. So that those are the scientific facts. My unscientific guess that I think is kind of fun is that, you know, fathers who play with their kids are going to have higher oxytocin levels. Oxytocin is associated with binding, and it might just make them better husbands. It might improve their relationships with their spouses. So playing with kids is not only good for kids, it can have all kinds of consequences.
So it sounds like it might actually create a metabolic momentum that would reinforce itself.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that anybody has really looked at it in quite that way yet, but I'm sure people will want to because it seems like an obvious thing.
In the chapter you have on child rearing in Do Fathers Matter, you talk about the way that fathers have different responses to the cries of infants than mothers, and also have different ways of interacting with the infants. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I can. So we know that fathers are connected to, I think this is what you're asking about. We know that fathers are connected to their infants because of some interesting work done at the University of Michigan by putting fathers into brain scanners in certain kinds of circumstances. So they would do it when fathers could listen to any baby cry. They would do it when fathers were listening to any obnoxious, unpleasant sound, which crying is one of those, but there are lots of others. And they would do it when fathers listened to their own babies cry. And there was no question that, you know, certain areas of the brain responded in each case, but there was a distinct pattern when fathers heard their own baby cry. And the increased activity occurred in a part of the brain associated with emotional connections and emotional behavior. So, again, there's a lot of work remains to sort out what's going on there, why that happens, but it's very clear that fathers know their own baby's cry and know it distinctly different from other babies' cries. And then what else did you ask?
Oh, I was just interested in different behavioral approaches to infants and toddlers. Oh, that fathers, yes, have a, as I don't think people would be surprised, more of a potentially playful approach to interacting with their kids.
Right. So there's a few things. They definitely are more likely to roll around on the floor and engage in unstructured play and throw the kids up in the cover. My book has a picture of a father throwing a child impossibly high in the air, which mothers and even some fathers would quake at that. But fathers do those kinds of things. They also are more likely to let their kids climb a little bit higher on the jungle gym and take a few more chances in situations like that. And then one interesting story I found that I thought really typifies a lot of this, that some people talk about fathers as being a kind of bridge to the outside world, because in many families, fathers are still the ones who go out and spend time at work during the day. And one of the interesting things that happens when some researchers observe mothers and fathers in babies in swimming lessons. And the mothers tended to hold the babies, in a kind of grip with the baby's breast against their breast, okay, and the baby looking over their shoulder when they were in the pool with the babies. Fathers, more often than not, held the babies the other way around, face forward, you know, and with their backs to the father's bellies, looking out at the pool. And these researchers thought that was an emblematic thing, that, you know, mothers are sheltering a little bit more in that case, and fathers are pointing the child toward the pool and the world out there. Now, we don't want to overdo this thing. This does not explain all aspects of fathering and mothering, but it is one of those interesting little phenomena that do kind of capture some real thing that's happening there.
And another interesting thing was a study on the different timing of puberty in daughters, whether the father was present in the home or whether the father was absent.
Right. So we know that, you know, a big biological transition for young girls and boys, but the interesting research here was done on girls, on daughters, is entering puberty. So it's one of the huge life transitions. And a lot of things go on, a lot of physical changes, emotional changes, all those things. That's old news. We know all about that. But it turns out that when a father is not present in a family, girls enter puberty at a significantly earlier age. Now, this doesn't mean because the father isn't there to give advice or the father isn't there to help take care of them, nothing like that. Whatever is going on, this is affecting biology that the girls can't control. The fathers can't control. Nobody can. The fact that the father is away, young girls' biology changes dramatically, so they enter puberty earlier. And those girls, without fathers in the home, are at increased, there's an increased likelihood they will engage in risky sexual behavior and an increased likelihood they will become pregnant as teenagers. And we know that those things can make it difficult for a young girl to get established as an adult. So it's what's unclear is how this works. And the speculation is that perhaps the father's pheromones, or his scent, in other words, is picked up by the daughter's bodies, again, subconsciously, and that signifies either that things are okay or things are not okay. And the speculation is that if the father is not present, girls may feel like they're in an insecure family situation, and the body's automatic response might be to enter puberty early, prepare them for pregnancy early, so that they can get out of that insecure situation into their own families that might be more secure. So that part is speculation, but it seems to make sense. But whatever it is that the ultimate explanation is, it's very clear. We know now that very profound changes occur in teenage girls when their father is not in the house.
I would imagine there might be some concern around discrimination, using this information improperly, the wrong people using this information to discriminate against people in non-traditional partnerships or single parents, rather than just looking at this as one of many different things. I was wondering if you address that in Do Fathers Matter? People who are single parents or have two parents of the same gender.
Yes, I do a little bit. There was plenty to write about, two-parent families with a mother and a father, more than enough to fill a book, so that's mostly what I wrote about. But I did address a couple of things. One thing is that some of the experts I talked to think that single mothers, which we have a lot, some after divorce, some because some without divorce, but for a variety of circumstances, as we know, that what's important for them or can be important is to involve a male in the family. If they have a brother, a close friend, a neighbor, a cousin, anybody who can spend time with the kids, that's a helpful thing. Now, that's not going to do everything that a father would do, but it will do some of that. And nobody has yet looked to see whether a stepfather or a male figure can prevent some of these consequences related to puberty and so forth. So I certainly don't discriminate against single mothers or gay families. There's now a good body of research for both families with two fathers and families with two mothers that they can raise healthy and happy kids. There's no question about that. These questions about what roles the parents take and how they, you know, whether if you have a lesbian family with two mothers, do those girls go into puberty earlier? As far as I'm aware, nobody's looked at that level of detail in those families yet, but they will. And frankly, I think that, you know, the rest of us who are in, male-female families are probably going to learn a lot, because I have talked to some, I talked to a very interesting lesbian couple a couple of years ago. And, you know, I was curious about, you know, does one of them pick up more of the traditional father roles and the other more of the mother or what? And, you know, what they told me and what I've read, about other couples is they feel like they don't have stereotypes, gender stereotypes that they have to confront and deal with. They're inventing things on their own because there isn't, you know, such a long tradition of gay families and being public about how they live and raise their kids. So I think we're going to learn a lot from them as they work out their own ways of dealing with all these, child-rearing issues.
And certainly any upside of biologically of having a father in the home is overshadowed by the downside if you have a bad father, abusive or a father or there's sexual violence.
Yes, that's right. And I didn't say too much about that except to say, look, you know, we all know that. We know what's going on there. Somebody asked me in an interview, you know, what fathers can do that's bad for children. And I said, well, not much except for that. You know, sexual abuse or other kinds of emotional or physical abuse can be horrific for kids, as we know. So, that's to me, again, a subject of another book. And of course, it's been the subject of many books.
Sure.
Already. But yes, it's absolutely worth noting that there are circumstances where fathers can be very not only unhelpful, but dangerous.
So what's interesting in the book also is that, I mean, we find all these changes that happen in the father during pregnancy, and we find that the behavior and diet and lifestyle of the father and the grandfather can be passed down through generations, and also that fathers potentially contribute a different interactive approach that actually seems to be beneficial around language development.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we don't see a big influence on survival with the presence or absence of a father. How do we explain that paradox?
Well, it's a little bit unclear. It's tricky. And I put it in the book because I wanted to be clear that I was looking at all the evidence and being fair in how I assessed it. So, you know, as you say, there's one big study that looked at a lot of different societies done by a couple of anthropologists. And that was the question. If fathers are such a big deal and we think they're so important and contribute so much, then kids ought to do better if fathers are there than if fathers aren't there. So what they found was that the fathers had little or no effect on the children's mortality rate. So that's important. Mortality is something we want to avoid, premature mortality in kids. And if fathers don't have much of an effect, that's an important thing to note, which I did. But that's different from saying that fathers in the home are going to, you know, maybe more likely to have kids whose language develops more quickly and have, you know, larger vocabulary, or kids who do better in school, or kids who are more socially competent as adults, or kids who have less risk of disease or mental illness as adults because their fathers didn't have mental illness, and on and on and on. There's so many things in the book. So fathers may not affect the mortality rate is the short answer, but they clearly affect a lot of things about their children's lives.
And do you have a website that you could point our listeners to, Paul?
I do. It's paulrayburn.com. The last name is R-A-E-B-U-R-N. And people can find out more about the book. They can get a free excerpt if they sign up for the newsletter and find out where to buy it.
And is there any ongoing research right now that's particularly got you interested in waiting for the results?
Well, not a particular study, but I can say that an area that I'm quite interested in is the family courts and divorce law and so forth. Too many courts are still treating, you know, rubber stamping, you know, mother custody and treating fathers as breadwinners and not much else. And it's just so at odds with what we now know about fathers that, you know, I'm half hoping that some wealthy philanthropist will hear one of these things or see the book and say, you know, I'm going to buy copies for all the family court judges in my state so that they can see what's important here about fathers. That's a problem. I fear that it will be a long time before the family courts catch up with what we now know about the importance of fathers.
Well, thanks for being on the program today, Paul.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We are talking today to author Paul Rayburn, the author of Do Fathers Matter? What Science is Telling Us About the Parent We've Overlooked. You've been listening to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host. Stay tuned for the rest of the Monday morning radio zine.
Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Art Burst Northwest Saturday and Sunday, August 2nd and 3rd at Merrillhurst University. Art Burst Northwest is produced by and for artists, open for all to attend, and celebrating arts and creativity of the region, with the accompaniment of food, music, shaded dining, and lounging in a relaxed outdoor atmosphere. More than 100 Pacific Northwest artists from all media will show their work.
Again, that's Art Burst Northwest Saturday, August 2nd, from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m., and Sunday, August 3rd, from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. at Merrillhurst University, between the cities of Lake Oswego and West Lynn. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to the Health and Healthcare Forum. I'm Roberta Hall. Our series on health and healthcare features conversations about diverse health concerns. I enjoy these conversations, and I hope you do too. Today on the Health and Healthcare Forum, we have two guests. They are Laurel Kinsel, she's been on the program before, and Diana Rollman. Laurel is the, how is it said, chief?
I like chief. I'm the director of the Community Outreach and Engagement Corps of the Environmental Health Sciences Center at Oregon State University.
Okay, and her background, of course, is public health. Well, they're doing a lot of work with communities and some issues involving materials, mostly in the air, that affect people's health. Now we have devices that will